happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. A special in-depth presentation on 9/11. We're going to be approaching this from three different perspectives today. These will not be definitive reports, but rather enough information on each one to allow us a sense of pause, to reflect upon the official pronouncements by the commission that the only people involved in the 9/11 attack were those who were designated as the terrorist, and that there were no problems beyond that. We suggest that the official report on 9/11 is filled with discrepancies and out-and-out lies. Let us begin. From Russ Baker, this is about the suppressed Saudi 9/11 story. I'll quote this. Who, what, why has found evidence linking the Saudi royal family to Saudis in South Florida who reportedly had direct contact with the 9/11 hijackers before fleeing the United States just prior to the attacks? Our report connects some of the dots first laid out by investigative author Anthony Summers and Florida-based journalist Dan Christensen in articles jointly published in the Miami Herald and on the nonprofit news site BrowardBulldog.org. In early September of this year, Summers and Christensen reported that a secret FBI probe, never shared with congressional investigators or the Presidential 9/11 Commission, had uncovered information indicating the possibility of support for the hijackers from previously unknown Confederates in the United States during 2001. Now, we can reveal that those alleged Confederates were closely tied to influential members of the Saudi ruling elite. As reported in the Miami Herald, phone records documented communication dating back more than a year that connected a Saudi family then living in a house near Sarasota, Florida, with the alleged plot leader, Mohammed Adeh, and his hijacked pilots, as well as the 11 other hijackers. In addition, records from the guard house at the gated community tied Adeh's vehicle and his accomplices to the actual visits to the house. Although requiring further investigation, this information suggests that the house may have been functioning as an operational base for the hijackers. According to interviews and records examined by the Miami Herald, there were two individuals and their young twins abruptly departing their home in Sarasota only days before the 9/11 devastation. And they traveled to Arlington, Virginia, where they stayed briefly at another house owned by one of their fathers, a man named Ghazawi. Then, still well before 9/11, the entire group, now including the father, flew to London and then on to Saudi Arabia. The Sarasota house was sold in 2003, as was a penthouse apartment in another D.C. suburb, Roslyn, Virginia. The family do not seem to have set foot again in the United States. Now, there are new revelations. Building on these revelations, Who, What, and Why has found documents laying out that the family and their royal connections through a nest of Saudi corporations that share the name IRAD. And the father is the director of the IRAD Management Company, the UK division of it, trading and contracting company, which, among other things, holds the Saudi franchise for many multinational brands, including UPS. The brother of this man, whose name shows up on public records associated with the holding company has connections to the U.S. government via contracts. In 2008, records show the State Department paid them $11,733 for rental of facilities, presumably in Saudi Arabia. There is no indication that the company itself or any of its officers or employees have any connection to the 9/11 incident or knowledge of anything regarding the man's activities in the United States. Calls for comment to the company's main switchboard went unanswered during normal business hours. Its website was not functioning properly, and Saudi trade officials in the United States had not furnished alternative contact information. But the now-revealed link between the Ghazouis and the highest ranks of the Saudi establishment reopens questions about the White House's controversial approval for multiple charter flights allowing Saudi nationals to depart the United States beginning about 48 hours after the attacks, without the passengers being interviewed by law enforcement, despite the identification of the majority of the hijackers as being Saudi. In addition, the new revelations draw further attention to a web of relationships that include the long and close business, personal, and political ties between the Bush family and the Saudi royal family. Now, here's what we know, that Saudi money is woven throughout business ventures connected to the Bushes. Saudi funds even helped bail out George Bush's failing oil company early in his career. Jim Bath, a close friend of Bush in the Texas Air National Guard, went on to start a business in conjunction with two sons of powerful Saudi families, whose family provides banking service to the Saudi royals and also to Salem bin Laden, heir to the bin Laden family global construction empire and a half-brother of Osama bin Laden. So these are some of the issues. Now, the Ghazouai presence in the Sunshine State predated 9/11 by at least 6 years. In 1995, a young Saudi woman living in South Florida married a fellow Saudi native, and that was Anand's father, Ehsan, and his American-born wife, Deborah, bought the couple a stylish three-bedroom house in a gated community in Sarasota. The house remained in the elder Galley's names while the young couple lived there and began a family. 6 years later, less than 2 weeks before the 9/11 attacks, that family and their children left their home on or about August 30, 2001, in great haste, taking off in a white van. This was about the same time that the hijackers were purchasing their tickets for the targeted flights. The family apparently left with no advance planning, leaving behind almost all their possessions, abandoning three recently registered vehicles, including a brand new Chrysler PW Cruiser, in the garage and in the driveway. As the Herald explains, quote, there was mail on the table, dirty diapers in one of the bathrooms, all the toiletries still in place, all the clothes hanging in the closet, opulent furniture equal or greater in value than the house, the pool running with toys in it, the beds were made, fruit was on the counter, the refrigerator was full of food. It was like they went grocery shopping, like they went out to a movie. But the safe was open in the master bedroom with nothing in it, not a paperclip. A computer was still there, a computer plug in another room, and the line still there. Looked like they had taken another computer and left the cord. After public disclosure of Saudi involvement in the 9/11 attacks, people in the gated community took note of the rushed departure and the disappearance of the family. After all, the attackers were not just overwhelmingly Saudi nationality, but three of the four of the future hijackers had lived and trained to fly in Venice, Florida, just 10 miles away from the house. The complex's security officer alerted the FBI, which began an investigation into the house and found a lot of irregularities. Phone records showed communication dating back more than a year that connected those in the house with the alleged plot leader and his accomplices, including 11 of the other hijackers. So here then is the point. Why is it that this was not made a major part of the official investigation? Why is it that we have so much to ask and no one in the official position at Homeland Security, the CIA, or on the official panel looking in the same direction that we are? Back in a moment. Please stay with us. In this segment of our program, we're going to be exploring, Did 9/11 Justify the War in Afghanistan? A commentary by David Ray Griffin from Global Research. I'll be quoting this verbatim. There are many questions to ask about the war in Afghanistan. One that has been widely asked is whether it will turn out to be Obama's Vietnam. This question implies another. Is this war winnable? Or is it destined to be a quagmire like Vietnam? These questions are motivated in part by the widespread agreement that the Afghan government under Hamid Karzai is at least as corrupt and incompetent as the government the United States tried to prop up in South Vietnam many years ago, and for over 20 years. Although there are many similarities between these two wars, there's also a big difference. This time, there is no draft. If there were a draft, so that college students and their friends back home were being sent to Afghanistan, there would be a huge group of demonstrations against this war on campuses all across this country. If the sons and daughters of wealthy middle-class parents were coming home in boxes, or with permanent injuries or post-traumatic stress syndrome, this war would have been stopped long ago. People have often asked, did we learn any of the lessons of Vietnam? The U.S. government learned one. If you're going to fight unpopular wars, don't have a draft. Hire mercenaries. There are many other questions that have been and should be asked about this war, but in this essay, I focus only on one. Did the 9/11 attacks justify the war in Afghanistan? This question has thus far been considered off limits, not to be raised in polite company, and certainly not to be in the mainstream media. It has been permissible, to be sure, to ask whether the war during the past several years has been justified by those attacks so many years ago, but one has not been allowed to ask whether the original invasion was justified by the 9/11 attacks. However, what can be designated the McChrystal moment, probably brief period during which the media are again focused on the war in Afghanistan in the wake of the Rolling Stone story about General Stanley McChrystal, the commander of U.S. NATO forces in Afghanistan, which led to his resignation, provides the best opportunity for some time to raise fundamental questions about this war. Various commentators have already been asking some pretty basic questions about the effectiveness and affordability of the present counterinsurgency strategy, and even whether American fighting forces should remain in Afghanistan at all. But I'm interested in an even more fundamental question, whether this war was ever really justified by the publicity that was put out, given as the reason, the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. This question has two parts. First, did these attacks provide a legal justification for the invasion of Afghanistan? And second, if not, did they at least provide a moral justification? Let's look at the first. Did 9/11 provide legal justification for the war in Afghanistan? Now, since the founding of the United Nations in 1945, international law with regard to war has been defined by the UN Charter. Measured by this standard, the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has been illegal from the outset. Marjorie Cohen, a well-known professor of international law, wrote this in November of 2001. The bombings of Afghanistan by the United States and United Kingdom are illegal. In 2008, Cohen repeated this argument in an article entitled Afghanistan, the Other Illegal War. The point of the title was that, although it was by then widely accepted that the war in Iraq was illegal, the war in Afghanistan, in spite of the fact that many Americans did not realize it, was equally illegal. Her argument was based on the following facts. First, according to international law as codified in the UN Charter, disputes are to be brought to the UN Security Council, which alone may authorize the use of force. Without this authorization, any military activity against another country is illegal. Second, there are two exceptions. One is that if your nation has been subjected to an armed attack by another nation, you may respond militarily in self-defense. This condition was not fulfilled by the 9/11 attacks. however, because they were not carried out by another nation. Afghanistan did not attack the United States. Indeed, the 19 men charged with the crime were not Afghans. The other exception occurs when one nation has certain knowledge that an armed attack by another nation is imminent. Too imminent to bring the matter to the Security Council. The need for self-defense must be, in the generally accepted phrase, instant, overwhelming, leaving no choice or means and no moment for deliberation. Now, although the U.S. government claimed that its military operations in Afghanistan were justified by the need to prevent a second attack, this need, even if real, was clearly not urgent, as shown by the fact that the Pentagon did not launch its invasion until almost a month later. U.S. political leaders have claimed to be sure that the U.N. did authorize the U.S. attack on Afghanistan. This claim, originally made by the Bush-Cheney administration, was repeated by President Obama in his West Point speech in December 2009, in which he said, "The United Nations Security Council endorsed the use of all necessary steps to respond to the 9/11 attacks." So U.S. troops went to Afghanistan under the banner of international legitimacy. However, the language of all necessary steps is from UN Security Council Resolution 1368, in which the Council, taking note of its own responsibilities under the Charter, expressed its own readiness, quote, to take all necessary steps to respond to the terrorist attacks 9/11-2001. Of course, the UN Security Council might have determined that one of these necessary steps was to authorize an attack on Afghanistan by the United States, but it did not. Resolution 1373, the only other Security Council resolution about this issue, laid out various responses. But these included matters such as freezing assets, criminalizing the support of terrorists, exchanging police information about terrorists, and prosecuting terrorists. The use of military force was not even mentioned. The U.S. war in Afghanistan was not authorized by the UN Security Council in 2001. Or at any time since. So this war began as an illegal war and remains an illegal war today. Our government's claim to the contrary is false. This war has been illegal, moreover, not only under international law, but also under U.S. law. The UN Charter is a treaty, which was ratified by the United States, and according to Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution, any treaty ratified by the United States is part of, quote, the supreme law of the land, end quote. The war in Afghanistan, therefore, has from the beginning been in violation of U.S. as well as international law. It could not be more illegal. Secondly, did 9/11 provide moral justification for the war in Afghanistan? The American public has, for the most part, probably been unaware of the illegality of this war, because this is not something our political leaders or our corporate media have been anxious to point out. So most people simply do not know. If they were informed, however, many Americans would be inclined to argue that, even if technically illegal, the U.S. military effort in Afghanistan has been morally justified, or at least it was in the beginning, by the attacks of 9/11. For a summary statement of this argument, we can turn again to the West Point speech of President Obama, who has taken over the Bush-Cheney account of 9/11. Answering the question why Americans and our allies were compelled to fight a war in Afghanistan in the first place, Obama said, quote, "We did not ask for this fight. On September 11, 2001, 19 men hijacked 4 airplanes and used them to murder nearly 3,000 people. They struck at our military and economic nerve centers. They took lives of innocent men and women and children without regard to their faith, race, or station. As we know, these men belong to Al-Qaeda, a group of extremists who have distorted and defiled Islam." End quote. Now, this standard account can be summarized in terms of 3 points. 1. The attacks were carried out by 19 Muslim members of Al-Qaeda. 2. The attacks have been authorized by the founder of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, who was in Afghanistan. And 3, the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan was necessary because the Taliban, which is in control of Afghanistan, refused to turn bin Laden over to the U.S. authorities. On the basis of these 3 points, our political leaders have claimed that the United States had the moral right, arising from the universal right of self-defense, to attempt to capture or kill bin Laden and his al-Qaeda network to prevent them from launching another attack on our country. The only problem with this argument is that all three points are false. Let me show you by looking at these points in reverse order. 1. Did the United States attack Afghanistan because the Taliban refused to turn bin Laden over? Now, the claim that the Taliban refused to turn over bin Laden has been repeatedly made by political leaders in our mainstream media. Reports from the time, however, show the truth to be very different. Who refused whom? 10 days after 9/11, CNN reported, quote, "The Taliban refused to hand over bin Laden without proof or evidence that he was involved in last week's attacks in the United States." The Taliban ambassador to Pakistan said Friday that deporting him without proof would amount to an insult to Islam, end quote. CNN also made clear that the Taliban's demand for proof was not made without reason, saying, quote, "Bin Laden himself has already denied he had anything to do with the attacks, and Taliban officials repeatedly said they could not have been involved in the attacks," end quote. However, Bush, quote, said the demands were not open to negotiation or discussion. With this refusal to provide any evidence of bin Laden's responsibility, the Bush administration made it impossible for the Taliban to turn him over. As Afghan experts quoted by the Washington Post pointed out, the Taliban, in order to turn over a fellow Muslim to an infidel Western nation, needed a, quote, face-saving formula. Milton Burden, who had been the CIA station chief in Afghanistan in the 1980s, put it this way, quote, "While the United States was demanding, give up bin Laden, the Taliban were saying, do something to help us, give him up." The Bush administration refused. After the bombing began in October, moreover, the Taliban tried again, offering to turn bin Laden over to a third country if the United States would stop the bombing and provide evidence of his guilt. But Bush replied, quote, "There's no need to discuss innocence or guilt. We know he's guilty." An article in London's Guardian, which reported this development, was entitled, quote, "Bush rejects Taliban offer to hand bin Laden over." So it was the Bush administration, not the Taliban, that was responsible for the fact that bin Laden was not turned over. In August of 2009, President Obama, who had criticized the U.S. invasion of Iraq as a war of choice, said the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, quote, "This is not a war of choice. This is a war of necessity." But the evidence shows, as we have seen, that, like the one in Iraq, this is a war of choice. 2, what was the motive for the invasion? This conclusion is reinforced by reports indicating that the United States had made the decision to invade Afghanistan 2 months before the 9/11 attacks. At least part of the background to this decision was the United States' longtime support of the UNOCAL's proposed pipeline, which would transport oil and natural gas from the Caspian Sea region to the Indian Ocean through Afghanistan and Pakistan. This project had been stymied through the 1990s because of the civil war that had been going on in Afghanistan since the Soviet withdrawal in 1989. In the mid-1990s, the U.S. government had supported the Taliban with the hope that its military strength would enable it to unify the country and provide a stable government which could protect the pipeline. But by the late 1990s, the Clinton administration had given up on the Taliban. When the Bush administration came to power, it decided to give the Taliban one last chance. During a 4-day meeting in Berlin in July of 2001, representatives from the Bush administration insisted that the Taliban must create a government, quote, of national unity by sharing power with factions friendly to the United States. The representatives reportedly said, quote, "Either you accept our offer of a carpet of gold, or we bury you under a carpet of bombs," end quote. After the Taliban refused this offer, the U.S. officials told a former Pakistan foreign secretary that, quote, "military action against Afghanistan would go ahead before the snow start falling in Afghanistan by the middle of October at the least," end quote. And indeed, given the fact that the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon occurred when they did, the U.S. military was able to mobilize to begin its attack on Afghanistan on October 7th. It appears, therefore, that the United States invaded Afghanistan for reasons far different from the official rationale according to which we were there to capture Osama bin Laden. There are some serious questions being raised about evidence at the crash site. One of the purported proofs that 19 men identified as the hijackers were on the planes was a reported discovery of some of their passports at crash sites. But the reports of these discoveries are not believable. For example, the FBI claimed that while searching the streets after the destruction of the World Trade Center, they discovered the passport of one of the hijackers on American Flight 11, which had crashed into the North Tower. But for this to be true, the passport would have to have survived the collapse of the North Tower, which evidently pulverized almost everything in the building into fine particulates of dust, except the steel and also this passport. But this claim was too absurd. The idea was this passport had escaped somehow the inferno unsinged. A British commentator said, quote, "With the credulity of the staunchest supporter of the FBI's crackdown on terrorism, believe this. By 2004, the claim had been modified to say a passerby picked it up and gave it to an NYPD detective shortly before the World Trade Center towers collapsed. So, rather than needing to survive the collapse of the North Tower, the passport merely needed to escape from the terrorist pocket or luggage, then from the plane's cabin, and then from the North Tower without being destroyed or even singed by the giant fireball. This version was no less ridiculous than the first, and the other stories about passports at crash sites frankly absurd. Hence, in this report, we have simply asked some questions that beg for independent investigation, that asks for independent evaluation. Clearly, the official story of 9/11, and hence its justifying our going into Afghanistan, should be challenged. I'm Gary Knoll. In a moment, we're going to speak with Mark Gaffney. Mark Gaffney is going to talk about, look at the other aspects of 9/11, the money factor to orchestrate 9/11, the Flight 93 crash in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, what 9/11 teaches us about false flag operations, and perhaps on in Syria. And he is a researcher, an environmentalist, peace activist. And his first book was a pioneering study about the Israeli nuclear weapons program. He's worked for Greenpeace, No More Chernobyls, National Audubon Society. We'll talk with him coming back in a little bit. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, let's go over and say hello to my guest, Mark Gaffney. I gave you his background and his most recent book, Black 9/11, Money, Motive, and Technology, with a foreword by consensus 9/11 panelist, a gentleman who I had on just yesterday, Adam Moynihan, which tackles the questions of financial activities before and after 9/11, and the events surrounding the questionable crash of UAL 93 in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and other topics. Nice to have you with us today, Mark.
Very happy to be with you, Gary.
Mark, there are some issues that I'd like for you to go into great depth. And again, based upon how I do this program, lay out an argument and then see how you can deconstruct the official position using hard forensic evidence. Not supposition, not theory, but hard evidence, okay?
Great.
Good.
Well, you know, let me just mention, Gary, the good news, that it does appear we are near a tipping point. I just heard a new poll, and if it's accurate, there's been a shift in public opinion on 9/11. something like 48% of the population either outright rejects the official story or is skeptical, and only 40% is convinced that the official story is correct. So we could be close to a tipping point, and I think it's very important.
I agree with that. Thank you for sharing that. The commission report concluded that it would have only cost al-Qaeda approximately $500,000 to have orchestrated 9/11, according to the official scenario of events. However, when you take into account all of the other contradictory evidence and then consider that it was a government black flag operation, if it was, all right, that's just a supposition. Explosives in the tower, many private security firms, high-level individuals involved who would have certainly have required payoffs, the Saudis, the Pakistanis, secret intelligence, and so much more. The cost would have been astronomical. So if this money were coming from the government purse, that's one thing. It would have created some budget discrepancies. Or were their secret accounts, such as through the CIA, that would have been available to the Bush White House? I'm merely saying these as suggestions from some people who have posited that this was possible. I'm going to ask you whether or not this was possible, and if not, why not? And if so, then show us your evidence on this.
Well, there's both supposition, and then there are things we can say that where we do have evidence. The $500,000 that the hijackers allegedly used, according to the 9/11 Commission, is just pocket change compared with the pre-9/11 spike in the money supply. There was a spike in the M1 aggregate, according to a gentleman who used to work at the Federal Reserve of Chicago, Bill Bergman, who contacted me to inform me about this. And this was, we're talking about $100 bills. And you have to wonder, what was going on here. And this never got a lot of publicity. The press never really focused on this. But, it looks to me like it could have been preparations for the war in Afghanistan, in part because we know that the CIA turned up in Afghanistan with suitcases full of $100 bills, which they were passing out to drug lords, and the Northern Alliance, so-called, to fund the war and to buy support there. So that is one very suspicious piece of evidence. That's hard evidence. We know that there was a spike in the money supply that makes the pre-9/11 that makes the 500,000 or so that the hijackers used to fund the operation look small.
All right.
And then we have very suspicious circumstances after 9/11 on Wall Street, where you had a lot of damage there in southern Manhattan. The southern tip of Manhattan there, real confusion and chaos in the security market, where there were weeks there when $100 billion in securities was simply unaccounted for, and it seemed to be concentrated in the Bank of New York, because the other clearing bank, J.P. Morgan, did not report any such discrepancies, and neither did Deutsche Bank.
What about,
which actually took a lot more damage.
What about the unusual trading? What about the unusual financial activities the day before 9/11 and on the day of 9/11?
Well, yeah, the evidence of money laundering, and
yes.
There have been three academic studies that support the contention that there was money laundering going on. Statistical studies by academics, then this, too, has not gotten attention in the press. This should have been headline news, but, they just whiffed on it. So it does look like people were in the know, and, it looks like...
Give us examples, please.
Yeah, the number three man at the CIA was implicated in... and money laundering. This was leaked through the Independent. I don't think it got very much press coverage here in the United States. But this was traceable through Deutsche Bank, which had already bought out Bankers Trust, and that was worthy of the CIA official had worked. And, you know, it's complicated because there were a lot of mergers before 9/11, but these banks had a history of fraud and corruption on Wall Street. Bankers Trust had a real loose reputation. In fact, they almost got closed down, and they were bought up by Deutsche Bank there.
But that
so when you look at the banks, their history, you know, it's a shoddy history. I mean, it's just these banks are capable of anything. The Bank of New York was engaged in money laundering through the 90s. They had this scam to launder money out of Russia to the tune of at least $10 billion, maybe as much as 20. And they got caught on that. They were caught, and but the case actually dragged on because of 9/11. And even after it was settled and they agreed to clean up their act, the Bank of New York was implicated again in 2009 for another whole scam, an exchange fraud involving U.S. pension funds. They were ripping off pension funds. And this had been going on for at least 10 years. So it was going on even during the other investigation, the earlier investigation.
But in and of itself, that
does... They have no shame, you know?
I understand that, and I don't think anyone in this audience believes what banks say or respects how they make their money. That in itself, however, no matter what they've done in the past, as far as laundering money or dealing with criminals or organized crime, doesn't mean that they were part of 9/11. So I just want to be clear that we have to separate out the two. More specifically, I'd like for you to talk about something that there's a great many contradictions on, and that is the United Airline 93 crash near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. What is the official story we're told? And then go through that official story step by step, including eyewitnesses and observations of other planes, including unidentified aircraft with possible weapon capabilities that were excluded from the official commission. Take this step by step.
Well, the official story is that Flight 93 crashed because the passengers were about to take over the plane, and the hijackers just turned it nose down and crashed it. But when you look at the evidence, that explanation seems very unlikely, because the we have a debris field 8 miles away from the crash site, and it's impossible to explain how the debris was thrown up in the air and traveled 8 miles, if the official story is correct. It appears that the plane broke up in the air, like thousands of feet up, that the fuselage must have been breached. I think that's the only thing that could explain the debris field 8 miles from the crash site. We also have parts of the official story could be correct. You know, parts of it probably are correct. But the cause of the crash, no, I don't think so. I believe that something went wrong with 93. The plan was probably to crash it into Building 7, perhaps, or in Washington, perhaps. We don't know. Possibly the Capitol. But something went wrong, and the I think the perpetrators had to resort to a backup plan, because the hijackers could not be allowed to survive. The passengers on the plane could not be allowed to survive to tell the story, which would have exposed the operation. So it's also interesting that we have a witness in the area, Susan McElwain, who describes seeing what appears to be an unmanned aerial vehicle, a drone, came right down over her car, about 40 feet off the ground. This was just moments before the crash of Flight 93, about half a mile away from where she was. And if that's true, if this eyewitness account is true, and I have talked with her and checked her out, and she's totally credible, you know, just a witness that was completely ignored. It's possible there was a platform in the area for some kind of a a shoot down. Now, this is speculation, but we do have an unexplained account there. And we know from the radar data, we have the radar data from 9/11. I worked with the gentleman who did the, John Farmer, who pursued the Freedom of Information Act request. And we know that none of the NORAD aircraft, none of the fighters got anywhere near Flight 93. So it was not shot down by a fighter plane. So, yeah, when you put it all together, it's very suspicious. Well, I went to Shanksville in the course of researching my book, and one of the main reasons I went was to try to confirm reports of an unexplained power outage there in the area of Shanksville. And I was, it only took me a couple hours to confirm it. I ran into a number of people who lived there, residents, who told me that, you know, just moments before the crash, their TV went out, the phone went out, they had a power outage there, and that this is local, very local, and it was never explained. Okay, the utility company could not explain what happened.
The utility company acknowledge there was a power outage?
Oh yes, but they were not able to explain it.
Were there any weather conditions or any earthquakes, anything at all in the area that could have explained it?
No, there were not, nor were there any power lines right by the crash site. So you have to wonder. That evidence would be consistent with the use of a high-powered microwave, you know, that kind of device, which I speculate could have been used. It could explain all the phenomena surrounding the crash.
Mark, let's go. You're making some noise there with paper movement. Mark, let's go to the actual crash site. What was recovered from the crash site? What could be identified? How many bodies were recovered? How many bodies were identified?
Well, I did not personally investigate the issue of the bodies, but I did. I did talk to a farmer who lives about quarter mile or less from the crash site, and he was out in his front yard shoveling coal that morning, and he told me he saw the crash. Plane came right in, and his farm was just littered with debris. I mean, there were little pieces of debris scattered over the entire countryside, and this is consistent with the other accounts that I heard from people I talked to. I talked with the people who were the first to arrive at the crash site, and they had driven there in a pickup truck, and even as they were approaching the crash site, their little pieces of debris were landing in the back of the truck. So it does appear that, to me, that the plane broke up in the air before it hit, and I don't think you can rule out the possibility of an explosion, and that's what it looks like to me. And that would explain the absence of large pieces of fuselage. They did find two engines. According to the, one engine was about 1,300 feet away from the hole, and then there was another one they supposedly pulled out of that hole. But I think the plane broke up. I think that's what happened.
All right.
I don't have any doubt that it was Flight 93 because we have it on radar the entire flight.
Okay, so what we have is we have some contradictions to the official position. You have most of the debris ending up 8 miles from where the crash supposedly occurred. That could, and there's no law of physics that would allow a group of parts of a plane to bounce out of the ground, bounce out 8 miles. It's not possible.
Not possible, that's right. Now, I wouldn't say most of the debris, but there was significant debris at New Baltimore, which is right along the Pennsylvania Turnpike there. It's about 8 miles from Shanksville.
Okay, well, the only way that could happen is if it started to come apart in midair. And then based upon the parts that were coming apart, generally if a plane just broke in half, it's not going to disintegrate in that little amount of space between where it would disintegrate and hit the ground. You wouldn't have vaporization. The only way you're going to have vaporization is if some form of missile hit it and there was an explosion. And an explosion, depending upon the materials used, could cause the vaporization material, hence debris spread over a long period of space, and coming down in different form, hence making it unlike any other plane crash. Now, I looked at over 100 plane crash photographs over the last 40 years, and you will see all the debris within a relatively small area, and you will see large pieces of the plane, and you will see seats, sometimes the people in the seats, other times luggage, baggage all over the place. You didn't see any of that. This was not a typical plane crash site. Is that not
correct? That's right. And absolutely. And this has led a lot of people down, you know, dead end paths into cul-de-sacs, concluding that, well, it couldn't have been Flight 93 at all. You know, it had to be either some other plane or 93 crashed somewhere else, or what happened to 93, you know, on and on. But the combination of the radar data and the records we have of the actual recordings of the air traffic controllers, all of that is consistent. It mutually corroborates, and it's consistent with a crash at Shanksville. So I believe that the plane did go down there, but I believe that there had to be an explosion. We don't know what caused by what. There was some evidence that one of the hijackers had a bomb on board, and I didn't discuss that in the book. I wish I had discussed it, but that is a possibility also.
What do you have in the way of evidence for the people actually who hijacked the plane, that plane, on board?
Well, I believe that part of the official story about 93 is correct. I believe the hijackers were on board. We have there was one call from one of the passengers who was in the restroom. This was just before it went down. I think the plane was probably very low, maybe 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, something like that. And he was obviously terrified. And he told the woman and whoever took his call that, you know, there had been an explosion. He was looking at smoke, and you know, he indicated that their plane had been hijacked. But then the phone call was broken off. Now, I think that I'm very skeptical about most of the calls from the planes, but I think this could have been one that was real. There was a document released, part of the 9/11 Commission records, recently, that indicated that he had connected with 911, and the 911 number was the county just west of where the crash occurred. So, you know, this indicated to me that this might have been a real cell phone call.
So let's just put together some of the information here. We have a witness, a credible witness that you have personally spoken with, so it's firsthand, not second or third-hand information.
Correct.
And this witness is credible to you, and she said that she saw some form of aircraft, probably a drone, based on the size of the description, hovering about 40 feet or so off the car and in the immediate vicinity of where the crash occurred.
Well, it wasn't hovering, but it did buzz her car, yeah. And
buzzed
then it went
her
over
car.
Some trees, and she lost sight of it.
All right.
And then the crash occurred right after that.
Right.
Now, she thought that it was this plane that crashed, until she found out later that, you know, Flight 93 was what crashed.
All right. But also with this, Mark, is that she was not invited to give testimony under oath at the commission.
Absolutely not.
And now, had she given that information, that would have immediately sent red flags up everywhere. You would have had major investigations asking what, because remember, back then we didn't have any really information on drones. This was pre-drone technology. But we also
the drone had just come of age in 2001, so it was very recent.
And nobody really knew about, the average person didn't know squat about drones. But the technology always precedes by anywhere from a year to 3 or 4 or 5 years, the public's awareness of it. So we have the red flag, the woman sees something, she sees then there's a crash, she's not invited to testify, yet they knew she existed.
Well, yeah, she went to the FBI with her story, and they came out to her house, but of course they didn't believe her, and they tried to tell her, oh, you didn't see that, you saw something else. You know, the familiar, what we've heard this so many times before, when they try to tell the witness what the witness saw.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't consistent with the story that they were.
So then we have debris that, based upon the laws of physics, numerous 9/11 skeptics who are qualified in with PhDs and scientists have stated on the record that this is not possible to have had a plane that crashed in one location have debris 8 miles away. That's another big red flag. We also know that there was a phone call made and that a person's talking about smoke and on the plane, which meant that it could have been hit by a missile, could have been there could have been a bomb detonated by one of the terrorists. In either case, it was a low altitude, and based upon the low altitude, the call went through, because anyone who's tried to call at a higher altitude knows it's nearly impossible to make those calls unless you make it with the phone system within the plane itself. Then we have the inconsistencies of the debris. These are not the normal crash site debris. And I'm asking, where are the bodies? Where are the forensics on these bodies to identify them?
The local examiner reportedly did find traces of, you know, human bodies and did that work. Although I certainly cannot, you know, confirm it. I did not investigate that area.
Okay. Well, were they able to confirm the DNA of all the people or people who were on there who were alleged to have been the terrorists? Their DNA would have been identified.
Well, I can tell you what happened with the case of the Pentagon strike. There was a lab set up where they went through all that evidence, and they did do a DNA traces on all the passengers. There were several, there were specimens that over and above the passengers that they assumed were the hijackers, but they never actually did that confirmation with the families of the hijackers.
So we have inconclusive evidence on who actually were on the plane as far as their DNA matching.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I believe hijackers were on the plane. As to who they exactly were, that is totally open.
We don't know.
We do not
know. All right,
know.
Well, these are the contradictions that spell out that we need a new, independent, scholarly investigation. I believe the American public is demanding it. And I believe that as the consensus swings towards, as you said, the tipping point, where at least when we get to 60% of the American public no longer trust the official position, then all of those thousands of 9/11 scholars and architects and physicists will come forward, and they will give the evidence, and then these witnesses will come forward and give the evidence, and then all the first responders, the police captains and the fire chiefs, and the medics and all the other people who heard detonations prior
That's
to
right.
the buildings collapsing, none of that was allowed. And
That's right.
even people were in the basement who I've personally spoken to who said a bomb went off in the wall behind us. I was thrown about 10 feet against the wall. One of my coworkers was thrown. He was injured. I had to carry him out of the building. And as I carried him out of the building, we rolled under a truck that was there. Otherwise, we would have been crushed to death. And yet, this information wasn't part of the official story. So,
that's right. And, Gary, we know that the 9/11 Commission had that testimony. They had the testimony from the firefighters, firemen from New York, 118 of them, and they just ignored it.
That's correct. Well, they didn't ignore it. They chose not to use it.
They selectively.
Selectively avoided using it because of what red flags it would have raised. If you have enough credible people who are experienced in detonations, who have a knowledge of what a bomb sounds like, and suddenly they're telling, a lot of them are saying, we heard detonations. And one person says, I was in the building with a group of people in the basement, and suddenly the wall blew out. And this is before the plane crashed into the building. Then you've got a problem. Then you've got something else happening. Then the official story is not going to hold weight. So the knowing this and keeping this out of the official report means there was a cover-up, which means that the public has every right to be skeptical, and that's what we are. We are skeptics. We cannot tell you what happened. We can tell you what didn't happen.
That testimony should have prompted the National Institute of Standards and Technology to do testing for residues of explosives. That was standard anyway. They should have done that, and especially given that you had over 100 firefighters reporting explosions, and then the fact that they did not test for residues I mean, that's another huge red flag.
That's a red flag, and that could not have been by accident. That was intent. Mark Gaffney, thank you very much for being on with us and sharing your concern and your evidence and your skepticism of the official report. And we hope that in the coming year or years, enough people will demand the truth that we'll have a new and proper commission.
It's been great, Gary. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Now let's say hello to Utrecht Lead, who's going to be continuing on 9/11 today. Hi, Utrecht.
Hello, Gary. Today it's open forum on Lead Stories, and we'll be discussing what connection, if any, do listeners see between the 9/11 attacks in 2001 and the situation with Syria today.
Excellent. Utrecht Lead, right now.